Asked to not to review the, strictly speaking, the CISO mechanism, but to review a conference which took place last Thursday and Friday on the 25th anniversary of the CISO mechanism, since it was in 1979 that the world realized the relevance of the CISO game to fundamental physics. So here is the program of the first day, June 10th, where there were some presentations of some of the historical contributors to the CISO mechanism, plus some theoretical talks, mostly. At the end of the first day, there was a sort of banquet excursion, and I must say that the organizers betrayed one of the best kept secrets in Paris, the place where the Parisians go in June when they want to avoid the big crowds of tourists. So I won't tell you exactly where we went. I'll just give you a clue. So now you have to find out the place. This is a famous scene from this movie. And if you want to, we had a chance of having a live performance of this scene by Michel Cribier on that night. So you might ask him for a new version of this. And so the next day, there were more talks and more experimental talks. I won't give all the credit they deserve to the experimental talks, otherwise I would be reviewing the whole neutrino conference. At the end of the day, there was a discussion, a roundtable discussion, opening towards the future. It was a very lively conference, I must say, with lots of discussions, heated discussions sometimes. And as any successful conference, it didn't go the way it was expected to go. So in the first day, the historical contributors, instead of giving details about the history of the CISO mechanism, gave a broad perspective. And at the end of the second day, the participant of the roundtable spent quite some time setting the records straight. So it just went the other way around. But that's, I guess, that's the secret of a successful conference. There were also some pictures taken by Daniel Vigneault, who was the official photographer. So I just have one of them, which involves two of the contributors to the CISO mechanism in a heated debate. Oops. That comes for later. So I'll show you. Okay. You'll have a picture in a couple of minutes. So the CISO mechanisms, it was places. Why is it so important from a point of view of neutrino masses? Well, it really places the neutrino center stage. And here is a sort of summary of all the issues that were discussed, some of the issues that were discussed in the conference. And I'll sort of, go around these different issues and some of the talks that were given at the conference. So let me first discuss symmetries, which were covered by Mohapatra, Ramon, Ross, Sejanovic, and Lindner. I'll borrow a transparency from Rabbi Mohapatra, which summarizes the famous CISO mechanism. So I remind you that if you have a cancellation of the Mariana mass of a left-handed neutrino coming from a low-energy theory, but if you allow for a Dirac mass and a right-hand Mariana mass for the right-handed neutrino, which breaks the B-L symmetry, and if you assume that the scale of breaking of the B-L symmetry is much higher, then you have a very natural solution to the smallness of neutrino masses that is observed. This is the CISO mechanism, or according to typology that I'll discuss later, type 1 CISO. And here you have the names of the authors, the names connected with the CISO mechanism, 79. And I guess here is a picture of two of them, Professor Ramon on one side, and Yanagida on the other side, discussing the CISO mechanism. That's a picture. That's a picture I was advertising from Daniel. The importance of the CISO mechanism lies, of this version of the CISO mechanism lies in the addition of the right-handed neutrino to a standard model, which opens up a new landscape of physics. It restores the quark-lepton symmetry, and so which is shown here, and so that opens up towards the ground unification. And it restores also the symmetry between left-handed components and right-handed components, the parity symmetry. And so that's why in this theory of the CISO mechanism, the left-right symmetric models, like SU to left cross SU to right cross U1, where you recover here the B minus L symmetry, played an important role. And to this scheme, Graham Ross, who was discussing textures and flavors models, added another direction, if you want, family symmetries, of which I will say a few more words later. So this is really the scales which are at play within within the neutrino, within the quark and lepton spectrum when you have introduced a right-handed neutrino as in the CISO mechanism. Of course, when you start discussing large scales, then you have to be careful with renormalization group running. And this was stressed by Manfred Lindner, who showed, for example, that even though some of the angles might be different, they might be identical at the large scale. And so the renormalization group effects are important and should be taken into account if you want to write a theory of neutrino masses at the large scale. Now, experimental data is putting the CISO mechanism into a new perspective. And, first of all, because neutrinos have a mass, so that's good news for the CISO mechanism. Second thing, it shows, and that's both at the level of masses and the level of mixings, that neutrinos might be sort of different species than quarks and charged leptons. This is transparency which I brought to Graham Ross, which shows precisely this. You have here mass scales, and the charged lepton and quarks lie in the region, in this region from tetrahedral 3 to tetrahedral 3, whereas neutrinos lie in somewhat apart from the rest of fundamental particles. And it's the same with mixings. I'll come back to that. We seems to have large mixings in this field, contrary to the small mixing of that is observed in quarks. Now, if we look at mass measurements, that was recalled by Pierre Ramon, again, the same thing I was just discussing, but with numbers. And if we want to discuss more fully the CISO mechanism, then we need to identify the absolute mass scale to see where the neutrinos are really lying in the plot of a previous transparency. So there were a couple of talks devoted to identifying the absolute neutrino mass. One of them was by Sien Annestad, who discussed neutrino masses from the point of view of cosmology. And as you know, neutrinos affect the structure formation because they're a source of dark matter and they free stream, so they tend to erode any structure on scale larger than the free streaming scale, which is something like 1 gigaparsec over the mass of a neutrino in electron volts. And this is a sketch here where you have structure formations in the case of four different scenarios with massless neutrino and with masses increasing, and that you see that the structures at small scales are somewhat eroded by the as the mass of a neutrino gets bigger, just because of the free streaming effect of neutrinos. Now, Steen Anastat gave a limit on the neutrino mass. Of course, this limit depends on the assumption that you make, whether you take just the del mu map data or you take some extra data. This is taking all available data. And of course, as was said in a previous talk, this is going to be improved. But that said, the scale, the neutrino mass, absolute neutrino mass, is smaller than something of the order of the electron volt. With a caveat, there could be more than one non-standard effect besides the neutrino mass, and that could severely bias the parameter estimate. You could have many effects on the cosmological side that would sort of change this limit. So this limit is very interesting, precise, but it's model dependent. So the other talk on the absolute determination of the absolute mass scale was by Christian van Heymer, who we call the cosmological aspects of this limit, by saying what I just said, very sensitive but model dependent. And the other two were discussed this morning, the neutrino double beta decay, and the direct neutrino mass determination using time of flight measurements of the kinematics of weak decays and beta decays. His conclusions were that in these two cases, these are complementary. The first one is very sensitive, but is depending on the phases and the mixing. So it gives you complementary information with respect to the cosmological result. And this is the only model independent method. And a Catherine experiment, which would set some stringent limits, was discussed earlier this morning. So one aspect was the mass spectrum and the absolute mass scale for the neutrinos. The other aspect is the mixing pattern. And here again, neutrinos seem to be different from quarks in the sense that when in the quark sector, one observes one small mixing angle, which is a Kabibbo angle. In this case, one observes one small and two large angles, and that's certainly, and it was discussed at length, this is certainly an indication that things are going differently in the neutrino sector. So this is a transparency brought to Pierre Ramon. And in ECHO, here is the analysis of Graham Ross, who stressed the fact that connected with large mixing angles, you might expect some, I was talking earlier about family symmetries, you are expecting a non-abelian structure to explain such large angles. And quite a few talks were devoted to, I mean, Pierre Ramon's talk, Graham Ross, and others were devoted to discussing precisely what kind of non-abelian structure could be behind such a structure of mixing. Now, so much for symmetries. Let me come to another group of talks which was devoted to leptogenesis and all the way to supersymmetry. And I'll borrow a couple of transparencies to Yana Guida, who will discuss these issues, just to show you a little starting from right-handed neutrino, you end up discussing the so-called gravitational problem in supersymmetry. So leptogenesis, which was discussed by several talks, Yana Guida reminded us that when you have a right-handed neutrino, heavy neutrino, you could produce a lepton asymmetry for its decays. Of course, if you have CP violation. And this is converted into baryon asymmetry by the Salaron effect. And the asymmetry parameter has this dependence, where you see here a ratio of right-handed neutrino over 10 to 10 GeV. So that sets the sort of relevant scales for Bayesian neutrino mass is interesting for leptogenesis. Now, there is a connected issue, which is inflation. If we believe in inflation, and cosmological data seems to be favoring such a scenario, then you have to remember that matter is created at the end of inflation. And so the Rankine neutrinos, as the other particles, should be created by inflation, inflaton decay, the decay of a field responsible for inflation. Because of inflation, the previous matter has been smoothed away. So it's at the end of inflation, there is a so-called phase of reheating with a decay of inflaton field, and that's where you produce Rankine neutrinos that will, in the end, in this scenario, lead to lepton number and baryon number. Now, if you hear, Yanagida wrote the ratio of lepton number to entropy or baryon number to entropy. The relevant scales now are the ratio of Rankine neutrino mass over the inflaton mass. And the important result is that if you want to be in the right ballpark for generating baryon asymmetry, then you need a reheating temperature. So that means the temperature of a matter that comes out of inflaton decay, which would be larger than 10 to the 6 GeV. And that poses a problem. And the problem that it poses is the following. If you start discussing scales like 10 to the 13 GeV, then you like to be in a supersymmetric scenario, just because you have new physics at very large scales, and so you want to avoid any problem of fine-tuning regarding the Higgs mass. So most of the scenarios, realistic scenarios, which are built in order to explain leptogenesis, are in a supersymmetric context. Now, if you have supersymmetry, and if you have gravity, you have a gravitino, which is the supersymmetric partner of a graviton. And gravitinos, as any other particles, are produced by thermal scattering processes after inflation. And so when the danger is to have too many gravitinos at the end of the day, because gravitinos are long-lived. And so this plot gives you the reheating temperature versus the gravitino mass and the constraints on the reheating temperature. And basically, this gives you the upper limit on the reheating temperature. And so you see that in scenarios where the gravitino standard supersymmetric scenarios where the gravitino is the order of TeV, then the reheating temperature is at most 10 to the 4 GeV, which is written here. And this somewhat contradicts the previous bound, which was telling you that you know, this scenario will be doing fine leptogenesis and inflation if the reheating temperature is larger than 10 to the 6 GeV. So this shows that you know, either you want to be in this region where the gravitational mass is light, or you want to be in this region where the gravitational mass is heavy. Yanagida was favoring in his talk the light gravitational scenario. I just gave this illustration just to show you how precisely, the CISO mechanism is central to many issues. If you have a right-handed neutrinos, you are very interested in the leptogenesis scenario, but then the leptogenesis scenario should be put in context, context of inflation, in the context of supersymmetry. And so you see that at the end of the day, because of these connections between all the different aspects of a single theory, then you start discussing the, you know, the mass of a gravitino, when you started with just a heavy right-handed neutrino necessary for the CISO mechanism. Very well. Another series of talk. There is another series of talk about supersymmetry, lepton flavor violation, extra dimensions. I'll just say a couple of words on extra dimensions, which was presented by Emilian Dudas. The right-handed neutrino is very special because it doesn't have any standard gauge interactions. And so if you look at models with extra dimensions where all the gauge interactions and all the fields sensitive to gauge interactions are localized on a surface, so-called brain scenario, then the right early neutrinos might be escape this localization on the brain, and so be very special fields. So that's one of the aspects of the extra-dimensional models that Emil and Dudas described. Again, this shows that the right early neutrino might be a very special field. Antonio Maziero discussed supersymmetric models, especially from the point of view of lepton flavor violations. This is the transparency brought to Antonio, where he compared lepton flavor violation and the CISO mechanism, and he compared the famous G mechanism in the standard model, where you have a very strong suppression, to the so-called super-GIM mechanism, which is the analogous of the GIM mechanism in the case of supersymmetric models, so similar diagrams, but with leptons, neutrinos, and neutralino and charginos. Just to stress the fact that in this case, the suppression might be not as strong as in the case of standard model, and so you expect, in the case of supersymmetric models, lepton flavor violation at a level which is much higher than in the standard case. And one example, which I again brought to Antonio Maziero, which is, I think, very striking. This is the branching ratio of mu into E gamma for a certain constrained MSSM for a very rather large value of tangent beta, note. But so this is the different values corresponding to different values of theta 1,3. And this is a current experimental bound. And this is a bound reached by LHC. And so you see that any improvement on mu into E gamma would put limits that might even be more powerful than LHC, for example, in this region. If in the next round of experiments, when gets better bounds on mu into E gamma. And so that leaves hope that when we'll discover some lepton flavor violations, which would be connected with this sort of super G mechanism, which is not as efficient as in the standard model. There were some discussions about the typology of CISO. I discussed the original model with right-handed neutrinos. There was, I call it typology of CISO or CISO or not CISO. There was an interesting discussion. Everybody was discussing the model with a triplet, SU2 triplet, scalar SU2 triplet, as a type 2 CISO. And Christoph Wetterich, who was participating to the debate, and with the author of this model considers that this is not type 2 CISO, but this is really a different model from CISO, what he originally called induced triplet. And so there was some discussion whether one should call this CISO or should call this induced triplet. Anyway, that's another kind of model, and you can go on and make more refined models, of course, and as you guess, there have been many different examples. Now, the big question was, can one test the CISO idea? And the big answer is, unfortunately, no. Why? Well, obviously, one cannot test the mechanism, and everybody agreed in the conference that the only thing one can test is the theory. And so you certainly cannot test the CISO mechanism by itself, but you can test the realization of this mechanism in an explicit theory. And so that's why one needs as complete theories as possible. So there's lots of discussion in this up to the end of the conference in the round table. Let me just give you some of the arguments that were exchanged. This is borrowed to Alexei Smirnov, who was playing the devil's advocate and who was trying to, what the duty of, given by the organizers, of showing alternatives to a CISO. So he started by criticizing some issues in the CISO. So here is an example of some of the arguments. There will be doubts on the CISO mechanism if lateral neutrinos are found. And if neutrino mass spectrum turns out to be quasi-degenerate. But again, these features could be accommodated in a CISO. So again, that shows that the CISO mechanism, the CISO idea is a very large idea. And of course, you can always cook up models that go against any statement that you made about the general properties of the CISO mechanism. Are there ways to prove a CISO mechanism? Well, discovery of the neutrinos W beta decay would certainly point towards the Majorana mass, but that's not enough to show that the CISO would be the main mechanism. Leptogenesis is difficult to test, and I was telling you about lepton violating decays. There are, of course, other assumptions in the game, and so you would really have to prove a given theory more than the general idea of CISO. In the roundtable, Christoph Wetterich was discussing the induced triplet, or type 2 CISO, if you want, mechanism, and he was claiming that this would be the dominating mechanism if, in two cases, if there is maximal nu mu nu tau mixing for generational, from generational symmetry. And he was making this statement that if you get this constraint, which would certainly be hard to prove, experimentally, then that would favor induced triplet mechanism, or if you have degenerate neutrino masses, but I guess everybody else was considering that these statements were too strong, and as I was saying in the previous transparency, this is not clear that, I mean, you can even accommodate degenerate neutrino masses. So there were lots of discussions about these issues, and I think that this just shows that what will be my conclusions, that 25 years later, the CISO mechanism is alive and well, and that still leads to heated debates, even though we know much more about neutrino masses, and even though what we know is certainly in favor of the CISO mechanism more than against it. Thank you.